Chapter 11. Because he had slept so late that morning, Ransom found it easy to keep awake the following night. The sea had become calm, and there was no rain. He sat upright in the darkness with his back against a tree. The others were close beside him, the lady, to judge by her breathing, asleep, and the unmanned doubtless waiting to arouse her and resume its solicitations the moment Ransom should doze. For the third time, more strongly than ever before, it came into his head, "This can't go on." The enemy was using third-degree methods. It seemed to Ransom that, but for a miracle, the lady's resistance was bound to be worn away in the end. Why did no miracle come? Or rather, why no miracle on the right side? For the presence of the enemy was in itself a kind of miracle. Had hell a prerogative to work wonders? Why did heaven work none? Not for the first time he found himself questioning divine justice. He could not understand why Maleldil should remain absent when the enemy was there in person. But while he was thinking this, as suddenly and sharply as if the solid darkness about him had spoken with articulate voice, he knew that Maleldil was not absent. That sense, so very welcome yet never welcomed without the overcoming of a certain resistance, that sense of the presence which he had once or twice before experienced on Perelandra, returned to him. The darkness was packed quite full. It seemed to press upon his trunk so that he could hardly use his lungs. It seemed to close in on his skull like a crown of intolerable weight, so that for a space he could hardly think. Moreover, he became aware in some indefinable fashion that it had never been absent, that only some unconscious activity of his own had succeeded in ignoring it for the past few days. Inner silence is for our race a difficult achievement. There is a chattering part of the mind which continues, until it is corrected, to chatter on even in the holiest places. Thus, while one part of Ransom remained, as it were, prostrated in a hush of fear and love that resembled a kind of death, something else inside him, wholly unaffected by reverence, continued to pour queries and objections into his brain. "It's all very well," said this voluble critic, "a presence of that sort. But the enemy is really here, really saying and doing things. Where is Maleldil's representative?" The answer which came back to him, quick as a fencer's or a tennis player's riposte, out of the silence and the darkness, almost took his breath away. It seemed blasphemous. "Anyway, what can I do?" babbled the voluble self. "I've done all I can. I've talked till I'm sick of it. It's no good, I tell you." He tried to persuade himself that he, Ransom, could not possibly be Maleldil's representative, as the unmanned was the representative of hell. The suggestion was, he argued, itself diabolical, a temptation to fatuous pride, to megalomania. He was horrified when the darkness simply flung back this argument in his face almost impatiently. And then, he wondered how it had escaped him till now, he was forced to perceive that his own coming to Perelandra was at least as much of a marvel as the enemy's. That miracle on the right side, which he had demanded, had in fact occurred. He himself was the miracle. "Oh, but this is nonsense," said the voluble self. "He, Ransom, with his ridiculous piebald body and his 10 times defeated arguments, what sort of a miracle was that?" His mind darted hopefully down a side alley that seemed to promise escape. Very well, then. He had been brought here miraculously. He was in God's hands. As long as he did his best, and he had done his best, God would see to the final issue. He had not succeeded, but he had done his best. No one could do more. 'Tis not in mortals to command success. He must not be worried about the final result. Maleldil would see to that, and Maleldil would bring him safe back to Earth after his very real, though unsuccessful, efforts. Probably Maleldil's real intention was that he should publish to the human race the truths he had learned on the planet Venus. As for the fate of Venus, that could not really rest upon his shoulders. It was in God's hands. One must be content to leave it there. One must have faith. It snapped like a violin string. Not one rag of all this evasion was left. Relentlessly, unmistakably, the darkness pressed down upon him the knowledge that this picture of the situation was utterly false. His journey to Perelandra was not a moral exercise, nor a sham fight. If the issue lay in Maleldil's hands, Ransom and the lady were those hands. The fate of a world really depended on how they behaved in the next few hours. The thing was irreducibly, nakedly real. They could, if they chose, decline to save the innocence of this new race, and if they declined, its innocence would not be saved. It rested with no other creature in all time or all space. This he saw clearly, though as yet he had no inkling of what he could do. The voluble self protested, wildly, swiftly, like the propeller of a ship racing when it is out of the water. The imprudence, the unfairness, the absurdity of it. Did Maleldil want to lose worlds? What was the sense of so arranging things that anything really important should finally and absolutely depend on such a man of straw as himself? And at that moment, far away on earth, as he now could not help remembering, men were at war, and white-faced subalterns and freckled corporals who had but lately begun to shave stood in horrible gaps or crawled forward in deadly darkness, awakening, like him, to the preposterous truth that all really depended on their actions. And far away in time, Horatius stood on the bridge, and Constantine settled in his mind whether he would or would not embrace the new religion. And Eve herself stood looking upon the forbidden fruit, and the heaven of heavens waited for her decision. He writhed and ground his teeth, but could not help seeing. Thus and not otherwise the world was made. Either something or nothing must depend on individual choices. And if something, who could set bounds to it? A stone may determine the course of a river. He was that stone at this horrible moment which had become the center of the whole universe. The Eldila of all worlds, the sinless organisms of everlasting light, were silent in deep heaven to see what Elwyn Ransom of Cambridge would do. Then came blessed relief. He suddenly realized that he did not know what he could do. He almost laughed with joy. All this horror had been premature. No definite task was before him. All that was being demanded of him was a general and preliminary resolution to oppose the enemy in any mode which circumstances might show to be desirable. In fact, and he flew back to the comforting words as a child flies back to its mother's arms, to do his best. Or rather, to go on doing his best, for he had really been doing it all along. "What bugbears we make of things unnecessarily," he murmured, settling himself in a slightly more comfortable position. A mild flood of what appeared to him to be cheerful and rational piety rose and engulfed him. Hullo? What was this? He sat straight upright again, his heart beating wildly against his side. His thoughts had stumbled on an idea from which they started back as a man starts back when he has touched a hot poker. But this time the idea was really too childish to entertain. This time it must be a deception, risen from his own mind. It stood to reason that a struggle with the devil meant a spiritual struggle. The notion of a physical combat was only fit for a savage. If only it were as simple as that. But here the voluble self had made a fatal mistake. The habit of imaginative honesty was too deeply ingrained in Ransom to let him toy for more than a second with the pretense that he feared bodily strife with the unman less than he feared anything else. Vivid pictures crowded upon him. The deadly cold of those hands, he had touched the creature accidentally some hours before, the long metallic nails, ripping off narrow strips of flesh, pulling out tendons. One would die slowly. Up to the very end that cruel idiocy would smile into one's face. One would give way long before one died, beg for mercy, promise it help, worship, anything. It was fortunate that something so horrible should be so obviously out of the question. Almost, but not quite, Ransom decreed that whatever the silence and the darkness seemed to be saying about this, no such crude, materialistic struggle could possibly be what Maleldil really intended. Any suggestion to the contrary must be only his own morbid fancy. It would degrade the spiritual warfare to the condition of mere mythology. But here he got another check. Long since on Mars, and more strongly since he came to Perelandra, Ransom had been perceiving that the triple distinction of truth from myth and of both from fact was purely terrestrial, was part and parcel of that unhappy division between soul and body which resulted from the fall. Even on Earth the sacraments existed as a permanent reminder that the division was neither wholesome nor final. The incarnation had been the beginning of its disappearance. In Perelandra it would have no meaning at all. Whatever happened here would be of such a nature that Earthmen would call it mythological. All this he had thought before. Now he knew it. The presence in the darkness, never before so formidable, was putting these truths into his hands like terrible jewels. The voluble self was almost thrown out of its argumentative stride, became for some seconds as the voice of a mere whimpering child, begging to be let off, to be allowed to go home. Then it rallied. It explained precisely where the absurdity of a physical battle with the unman lay. It would be quite irrelevant to the spiritual issue. If the lady were to be kept in obedience only by the forcible removal of the tempter, what was the use of that? What would it prove? And if the temptation were not a proving or testing, why was it allowed to happen at all? Did Maleldil suggest that our own world might have been saved if the elephant had accidentally trodden on the serpent a moment before Eve was about to yield? Was it as easy and as unmoral as that? The thing was patently absurd. The terrible silence went on. It became more and more like a face not without sadness that looks upon you while you are telling lies and never interrupts, but gradually you know that it knows and falter and contradict yourself and lapse into silence. The voluble self petered out in the end. Almost the darkness said to Ransom, "You know you are only wasting time." Every minute it became clearer to him that the parallel he had tried to draw between Eden and Perelandra was crude and imperfect. What had happened on Earth when Maleldil was born a man at Bethlehem had altered the universe forever. The new world of Perelandra was not a mere repetition of the old world Tellus. Maleldil never repeated himself. As the lady had said, the same wave never came twice. When Eve fell, God was not man. He had not yet made men members of his body. Since then he had, and through them henceforward he would save and suffer. One of the purposes for which he had done all this was to save Perelandra not through himself, but through himself in Ransom. If Ransom refused, the plan, so far, miscarried. For that point in the story, a story far more complicated than he had conceived, it was he who had been selected. With a strange sense of fallings from him, vanishings, he perceived that you might just as well call Perelandra, not Tellus, the centre. You might look upon the Perelandrian story as merely an indirect consequence of the incarnation on Earth. Or you might look on the Earth story as a mere preparation for the new worlds of which Perelandra was the first. The one was neither more nor less true than the other. Nothing was more or less important than anything else. Nothing was a copy or model of anything else. At the same time, he also perceived that his voluble self had begged the question. Up to this point, the lady had repelled her assailant. She was shaken and weary, and there were some stains, perhaps, in her imagination, but she had stood. In that respect, the story already differed from anything that he certainly knew about the mother of our own race. He did not know whether Eve had resisted at all, or if so, for how long. Still less did he know how the story would have ended if she had. If the serpent had been foiled and returned the next day and the next, what then? Would the trial have lasted forever? How would Maleldil have stopped it? Here, on Perelandra, his own intuition had been not that no temptation must occur, but that this can't go on. This stopping of a third-degree solicitation, already more than once refused, was a problem to which the terrestrial fall offered no clue. A new task, and for that new task a new character in the drama, who appeared, most unfortunately, to be himself. In vain did his mind hark back time after time to the book of Genesis, asking, what would have happened? But to this the darkness gave him no answer. Patiently and inexorably it brought him back to the here and the now, and to the growing certainty of what was here and now demanded. Almost he felt that the words "would have happened" were meaningless, mere invitations to wander in what the lady would have called an alongside world which had no reality. Only the actual was real, and every actual situation was new. Here, in Perelandra, the temptation would be stopped by Ransom, or it would not be stopped at all. The voice, for it was almost with a voice that he was now contending, seemed to create around this alternative an infinite vacancy. This chapter, this page, this very sentence in the cosmic story was utterly and eternally itself. No other passage that had occurred or ever would occur could be substituted for it. He fell back on a different line of defense. How could he fight the immortal enemy? Even if he were a fighting man instead of a sedentary scholar with weak eyes and a baddish wound from the last war, what use was there in fighting it? It couldn't be killed, could it? But the answer was almost immediately plain. Weston's body could be destroyed, and presumably that body was the enemy's only foothold in Perelandra. By that body, when that body still obeyed a human will, it had entered the new world. Expelled from it, it would doubtless have no other habitation. It had entered that body at Weston's own invitation, and without such invitation could enter no other. Ransom remembered that the unclean spirits in the Bible had a horror of being cast out into the deep. And thinking of these things, he perceived at last, with a sinking of heart, that if physical action were indeed demanded of him, it was an action, by ordinary standards, neither impossible nor hopeless. On the physical plane it was one middle-aged, sedentary body against another, and both unarmed, save for fists and teeth and nails. At the thought of these details, terror and disgust overcame him. To kill the thing with such weapons, he remembered his killing of the frog, would be a nightmare. To be killed, who knew how slowly, was more than he could face. That he would be killed, he felt certain. When, he asked, did I ever win a fight in all my life? He was no longer making efforts to resist the conviction of what he must do. He had exhausted all his efforts. The answer was plain beyond all subterfuge. The voice out of the night spoke it to him in such unanswerable fashion that, though there was no noise, he almost felt it must wake the woman who slept close by. He was faced with the impossible. This he must do. This he could not do. In vain he reminded himself of the things that unbelieving boys might at this moment be doing on earth for a lesser cause. His will was in that valley where the appeal to shame becomes useless, nay, makes the valley darker and deeper. He believed he could face the unman with firearms, even that he could stand up unarmed and face certain death if the creature had retained Weston's revolver. But to come to grips with it, to go voluntarily into those dead yet living arms, to grapple with it naked chest to naked chest. Terrible follies came into his mind. He would fail to obey the voice, but it would be all right because he would repent later on when he was back on earth. He would lose his nerve, as St. Peter had done, and be, like St. Peter, forgiven. Intellectually, of course, he knew the answer to these temptations perfectly well. But he was at one of those moments when all the utterances of intellect sound like twice-told tales. Then some crosswind of the mind changed his mood. Perhaps he would fight and win, perhaps not even be badly mauled. But no faintest hint of a guarantee in that direction came to him from the darkness. The future was black as the night itself. "It is not for nothing that you are named Ransom," said the voice. And he knew that this was no fancy of his own. He knew it for a very curious reason, because he had known for many years that his surname was derived not from Ransom, but from Ranulf's son. It would never have occurred to him thus to associate the two words. To connect the name Ransom with the act of ransoming would have been for him a mere pun. But even his voluble self did not now dare to suggest that the voice was making a play upon words. All in a moment of time he perceived that what was, to human philologists, a merely accidental resemblance of two sounds, was in truth no accident. The whole distinction between things accidental and things designed, like the distinction between fact and myth, was purely terrestrial. The pattern is so large that within the little frame of earthly experience there appear pieces of it between which we can see no connection, and other pieces between which we can. Hence we rightly, for our use, distinguish the accidental from the essential. But step outside that frame, and the distinction drops down into the void, fluttering useless wings. He had been forced out of the frame, caught up into the larger pattern. He knew now why the old philosophers had said that there is no such thing as chance or fortune beyond the moon. Before his mother had borne him, before his ancestors had been called ransoms, before ransom had been the name for a payment that delivers, before the world was made, all these things had so stood together in eternity that the very significance of the pattern at this point lay in their coming together in just this fashion. And he bowed his head and groaned and repined against his fate. To be still a man, and yet to be forced up into the metaphysical world to enact what philosophy only thinks. "My name also is Ransom," said the voice. It was some time before the purport of this saying dawned upon him. He whom the other worlds call Maleldil was the world's ransom, his own ransom, well he knew. But to what purpose was it said now? Before the answer came to him, he felt its insufferable approach and held out his arms before him as if he could keep it from forcing open the door of his mind. But it came. So that was the real issue. If he now failed, this world also would hereafter be redeemed. If he were not the ransom, another would be. Yet nothing was ever repeated, not a second crucifixion, perhaps, who knows, not even a second incarnation. Some act of even more appalling love, some glory of yet deeper humility. For he had seen already how the pattern grows, and how from each world it sprouts into the next through some other dimension. The small external evil which Satan had done in Malacandra was only as a line. The deeper evil he had done in Earth was as a square. If Venus fell, her evil would be a cube, her redemption beyond conceiving. Yet redeemed she would be. He had long known that great issues hung on his choice. But as he now realized the true width of the frightful freedom that was being put into his hands, a width to which all merely spatial infinity seemed narrow, he felt like a man brought out under naked heaven, on the edge of a precipice, into the teeth of a wind that came howling from the pole. He had pictured himself, till now, standing before the Lord, like Peter. But it was worse. He sat before him like Pilate. It lay with him to save or to spill. His hands had been reddened, as all men's hands have been, in the slaying before the foundation of the world. Now, if he chose, he could dip them again in the same blood. "Mercy," he groaned, and then, "Lord, why me?" But there was no answer. The thing still seemed impossible. But gradually something happened to him which had happened to him only twice before in his life. It had happened once while he was trying to make up his mind to do a very dangerous job in the last war. It had happened again while he was screwing his resolution to go and see a certain man in London, and make to him an excessively embarrassing confession which justice demanded. In both cases the thing had seemed a sheer impossibility. He had not thought but known that, being what he was, he was psychologically incapable of doing it. And then, without any apparent movement of the will, as objective and unemotional as the reading on a dial, there had arisen before him, with perfect certitude, the knowledge, "About this time tomorrow you will have done the impossible." The same thing happened now. His fear, his shame, his love, all his arguments were not altered in the least. The thing was neither more nor less dreadful than it had been before. The only difference was that he knew, almost as a historical proposition, that it was going to be done. He might beg, weep, or rebel, might curse or adore, sing like a martyr or blaspheme like a devil. It made not the slightest difference. The thing was going to be done. There was going to arrive, in the course of time, a moment at which he would have done it. The future act stood there, fixed and unalterable, as if he had already performed it. It was a mere irrelevant detail that it happened to occupy the position we call future, instead of that which we call past. The whole struggle was over, and yet there seemed to have been no moment of victory. You might say, if you liked, that the power of choice had been simply set aside, and an inflexible destiny substituted for it. On the other hand, you might say that he had been delivered from the rhetoric of his passions and had emerged into unassailable freedom. Ransom could not, for the life of him, see any difference between these two statements. Predestination and freedom were apparently identical. He could no longer see any meaning in the many arguments he had heard on this subject. No sooner had he discovered that he would certainly try to kill the unmanned tomorrow than the doing of it appeared to him a smaller matter than he had supposed. He could hardly remember why he had accused himself of megalomania when the idea first occurred to him. It was true that if he left it undone, Maleldil himself would do some greater thing instead. In that sense he stood for Maleldil, but no more than Eve would have stood for him by simply not eating the apple, or than any man stands for him in doing any good action. As there was no comparison in person, so there was none in suffering, or only such comparison as may be between a man who burns his finger putting out a spark and a fireman who loses his life in fighting a conflagration because that spark was not put out. He asked no longer, "Why me?" It might as well be he as another. It might as well be any other choice as this. The fierce light which he had seen resting on this moment of decision rested in reality on all. "I have cast your enemy into sleep," said the voice. "He will not wake till morning. Get up, walk 20 paces back into the wood, there sleep. Your sister sleeps also."